Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The Guardian.
Hey, this is Sian Kane.
And I'm Claire Armistead.
From the Guardian Books team. Before we get stuck into today's episode about the best new reading of the year and interview Josh Cohen about what we can learn from slackers, let's take a minute to tell you about Guardian Jobs, which is sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Now, we're only just back in the office after the new year, and yes, like most people, we're feeling it a bit. But it does make a difference having good company at work. Claire and I have already caught up on our Christmas reading, of which she has done none.
Oh, that's mean of you to out me in this context. Actually, I have done none, it is true. But I did say before Christmas that I was only going to do the zombie run app and do some running with Naomi Alderman.
Yes.
However, there has been so much literature-inspired television over Christmas, which is something that I usually don't have a chance to actually see as much of as I should. So I've watched The Long Song, Les Miserables. I'm in the middle of ABC Murders with John Malkovich, which I loved. I have no problem with the revisionist point. I'm absolutely fed up of David Suchet.
This is your way of telling us that you basically didn't do any running and you watched a lot of telly.
I watched a lot of telly.
Well, it's good to have you back in the studio, and Guardian Jobs can help you find your good company. It promotes a world of work where potential flourishes by connecting people with rewarding careers at like-minded organisations where values make the difference.
It makes it easy to find roles that are relevant to your sector, location and seniority level. So you can trust Guardian Jobs to help you find a role where you can make a difference for yourself and your employer.
And if you're a recruiter looking to attract a diverse candidate pool who share progressive values and are engaged with the world around them, trust Guardian Jobs to help you fill your vacancies with people who want to make a difference.
So find your good company at gu.com/good company. And now let's get on with this week's episode.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. I'm Sian Kane.
And I'm Richard Lee.
It's our first show for 2019 and we're very pleased to be back at work, particularly you, Richard, right?
Well, after speaking with Josh Cohen earlier, I'm not entirely sure.
So what is he here to talk to us about today?
He's talking about his latest book. Josh Cohen is an English literature professor at Goldsmiths and also a psychoanalyst. And he's written his latest is about not working, is the title. It's about making a case for inactivity, which is a kind of slightly paradoxical thing. Because what he's, alongside his two jobs, he's gone and written a book as well. That's one of the things that I want...
Really good at working.
One of the things I wanted to tax him about.
So what's his case? Why should we not be working?
Well, he seems to think that it's a notion that he traces back to the 16th century, that our sense of self-worth is all bound up with doing things all the time. And he seems to think this is, in the 21st century, this has reached a pitch that's unsustainable with social media and constant distraction and the ever-increasing demands of corporate life on our every waking minute. And he reckons that we need to be able to find a space to sort of step back, to find a space for actively being inactive.
That sounds quite nice.
<Doesn't it? Yeah. laughs> And he writes about artists as exemplifying what he calls the four different types, is the burnout, the slob, the daydreamer and the slacker. And so he writes about Andy Warhol and Orson Welles and Emily Dickinson and how they kind of managed to turn their various ways of not being active into actually producing very interesting work.
And so what people fit into those categories neatly, or could you be all four at the same time? I sort of feel like I maybe do that in one day.
He claims at least two for himself. So
okay.
I think it's not a rigid division between the two.
Okay, great.
So part of the reason I wanted to talk to him as well is not only the paradoxical nature of the entire book, but also also this idea that he has that analysis is a space for doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Confronted with someone who's in psychological distress, is this really enough? But we started off by, I started off by his subtitle is Why We Have to Stop.
Right.
Which sounds to me like a cry from the heart.
Yeah.
But I wanted to check, he's not actually really against working as such.
Yeah, okay.
No, I'm not. I don't think that's probably a tenable position either for me or for most people who might read this book. There was a lot of curiosity about this subtitle because, of course, it begs the question immediately, stop what? And it has a kind of slightly panicked quality to it. What is it that we have to stop? I didn't want it to be construed as a transitive verb, in other words, to stop something in particular. I wanted people to think of stopping as a kind of substantive activity or a substantive non-activity in itself. We're just into the new year and people are already persecuting themselves with stopping this or that. And what I thought would be interesting would be to think about just the fact of stopping itself. What would it mean to think about it as a verb in itself rather than as a path into some item on a to-do list?
The active possibility of inactivity.
The active possibility of inactivity. That's lovely. So if at the coming new year you say, I have to stop smoking, I have to stop eating so much fat, you'll find that this very quickly becomes another persecutory demand and in a way pulls away from the spirit of stopping. What I wanted to do with that subtitle was to get people thinking about the verb to stop as denoting a kind of substantive activity or a substantive inactivity. Lack of activity. To think of it not just as the negative of activity, but as a kind of state.
Because it's not exactly working as such that's a problem. It's more the suspect notion that we are in some sense defined by or limited to our work.
Yes, exactly. The human being, I think, in a 24/7 networked, overworked and overstimulated culture starts to be seen almost exclusively in terms of the visible record of activity and not just seen by others, but really seen by themselves.
It's almost that we start to value ourselves from the inside because of what we're producing,
what we're doing. Yeah, and so there's a kind of almost a confusion or a slippage of inner life into external life. This is obviously quite visible on social media, where in order to express oneself or give a sense of oneself, we tend to list all kinds of achievements, all kinds of external facts about ourselves.
Indeed, take photographs of them.
Yes.
Demonstrate that they have been done.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And pleasure starts to be seen in terms of its externalization. You know, one of the things about, say, Instagramming a meal is that it becomes a kind of public record or document of a pleasure that was enjoyed, but it gives no sense of sort of the textured experience of what it was, you know. And I find that the more glossy and even the more delicious looking the photo, the less I feel I can relate to it as a kind of real bodily experience.
So when do you think this notion that work is anything more than just the chores we need to get through to survive, where do you think this idea comes from?
I think it's quite deep rooted in the culture, but I think it has something to do with what the great sociologist Max Weber called the Protestant ethic. What Weber, in his great essay on the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, unearths is a sense of work in the modern period, defined quite broadly. This is a long modern period, starting in the 16th century, starting really with the dissenting church, with Luther. Work as a vocation, rather than a means of subsistence or even a means of ambitious movement through the world. Work as vocation, as calling, starts to have a kind of defining mark of the inner self. And then all of the inner life, all of selfhood, is somehow funneled through the fact of work. Work takes on religious significance. It becomes kind of definitive of the human being in an existential sense rather than in a merely pragmatic sense.
Yeah, because as soon as you don't have an exterior kind of church or an exterior authority to define whether or not you're going to be saved, you need to prove in some sense from the inside that you're worthy.
That's exactly it, yeah. And time starts to be seen as a kind of a commodity that always needs to be put to use. So you have, you know, dissenting clerics telling us that we need to take as much heed of our time and of preserving it and not wasting it as we would our gold and silver.
So you divide those who resist this regulation of their time into four-way taxonomy, the burnout, the slob, the daydreamer and the slacker. Which of the four types do you think you identify with most strongly yourself?
Yes, I will answer that one. Somewhere between the daydreamer and the slacker. I think I feel very identified with the slacker because I was a PhD student, because it took me a very long time to be drawn into that sort of grown-up, mature identity known as the working taxpayer. And I think it did sort of school me in other possibilities of what Roland Barthes called the idiorhythm. So it's a phrase, it's a term I love. And it basically means the rhythm of life and work that is specific to you, that runs in tune with your own kind of bodily and psychic rhythms. And my experience really of being a PhD student, which I write a bit about towards the end of the book, was that it was an exercise in learning my idiorhythm, and that when I try to adapt the research process and the writing process to a kind of regimented, dutiful notion of work, I went completely blank and indeed kind of sunk into a depressive inertia. This book isn't really a kind of blanket affirmative celebration of inertia. It does recognize that there is a depressive dimension to it, that it can leave us mired in a sense of kind of grim purposelessness.
Some of the case studies that you also describe, they describe people who are suffering from inertia of various sorts as
That's right. Yeah. And that's partly, I think, because they've only ever been able to define themselves in terms of their levels of attainment and accumulation. And so, in a sense, they run their idiorhythm according to an external agenda which has been imposed by external forces almost from birth, parents who have certain kinds of ambitions for them, and then sort of more increasingly abstract entities, schools, universities, vocational institutions, corporations, in the examples that I give in the book, for whom the goal of selfhood, to whom the goal of selfhood is sort of outsourced.
So that the capitalist corporations are kind of trying to control ourselves through this division of our time.
Yes, and I think it's not a coincidence that a lot of writers are very interested in the way that these corporate entities are not just trying to get a good working day out of us, but really trying to get a kind of employee identification. I mean, the most obvious example is Dave Eggers, who writes about this in The Circle, that it's not enough to contribute a part of one's time or a part of oneself to the flourishing of the company. One really must give oneself over to it, that they're really the ideal work, there would be no remainder.
It's interesting you should mention writers, because you exemplify each of your four types with and explore them as well through A Portrait of an Artist. You've got Andy Warhol, Orson Welles, Emily Dickinson and David Foster Wallace. So what's the relationship between art and inactivity that you're trying to draw out there?
First of all, yeah, there's a general idea of art running through the book, which begins with a kind of meditation on Tracy Emin's famous or notorious installation, My Bed. But I'm interested less in art that thematizes inactivity, that gives us representations of laziness or lethargy or indifference or slacking, although I am very interested in those things. I also wanted to get across the idea that art for us is a kind of protected reserve of inertia. Now, there are different ways we can think about this. One is simply that art is where we allow ourselves a certain level of gratuitousness. To write a piece of literature or to enjoy any piece of art is in a way to do something that doesn't have direct utility and purpose. And also it allows us to transition from a place of concrete reality with all the boundaries and obstacles and difficulties that concrete reality imposes into an imaginative world in which we can do whatever we want without really having to do anything. There's a lovely example of this in a book from the end of the 18th century by Xavier de Maistre, which he called Voyage Around My Room, in which he records, I mean, it's a memoir, really, of being put under house arrest for the crime of dueling, a very good aristocratic crime. And he gets stuck in his bedroom for 42 days. And he says, you know, they may have thought, the authorities, that this was a punishment, but it was a liberation, because in the confines of these four walls, I discovered the infinitude of my mind. And it's really about the pleasures of imaginative flight and how, really, if you want to liberate yourself from your chains, don't try to do it in the external world where you've really got a difficult task ahead of you and all kinds of external forces that want to get in your way. If you start, at least, in the space of your mind, you'll find you can go anywhere and do anything.
And yet these artists that you mentioned, they all, despite their various forms of inactivity, were immensely productive.
Yeah.
The things that they imagined in these imaginary spaces had real-world effects.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm fascinated by their prolificity because it seems to me that it was about more than just saying, well, I'm going to take a pause from the world to be inspired and then I'm going to produce something of monumental significance. It's more that each of the people I'm thinking about channeled a certain aspect of inertia into creative life without turning it into something else. So, for example, Emily Dickinson stays alone in her room and she daydreams herself into these extraordinary poems, which really changed, I think, the whole landscape, our whole sense of what was possible in modern poetry. And she does this not by creating something that is different from the daydreaming state of mind, but which bodies it in words. Warhol, of course, is an even more obvious example of this because he makes work around inertial states, motionless objects, sleeping bodies, dead bodies. He's fascinated by this zero state in which life is cancelled out. And he's, I think, trying to get us to commune with a dimension of that sort of living deadness in ourselves. And in doing this, he creates this quite immense life project, in some ways incessantly repetitious. But the repetition, again, is part of the inertial pull.
Is that part of the explanation for the paradox at the heart of the book, this book that you've written alongside your other two jobs?
Yeah.
That is, in fact, that is in some sense a call to do nothing, is in fact, by its very existence, the production of a very active mind.
Yeah, I think that's true. I want to distinguish it from the more commonplace notion that if you take a rest, you know, which is beloved of sort of corporate gurus, that it's good to take a rest, it's good to slow down a bit because then you'll be more productive. It's true that there are real creative and productive possibilities in inertia, but what I'm trying to say is that one doesn't have to become active or sort of busy in order to realize those creative possibilities. And what those four examples show really in very, very different ways is that there's something about the inertial impulse that can be marshaled for creativity, but in the form of inertia, not in the form of something else, not in the form of activity.
Is that also a way of explaining the problem that you might say that critics have with the very discipline of psychoanalysis, where in some sense that they say that it's just talk for mere sake of it?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and it's very much against the grain, and I think was at its inception actually, of a notion of quick fix solutions to mental health problems. The idea that really our aim is to go direct to the heart of the problem and to deal with it as efficiently as we can. Now, that to me betrays the very texture of the mind. What Freud discovers when he discovers this technique is not just something more efficacious. He's actually trying to mimic in the technique of the therapy the way the mind works. And he says the mind doesn't really respond to being penetrated directly. It tends to defend itself against that. It tends to ward off any attempts to get straight into its marrow. And so you have to walk gingerly around it in concentric circles. And so psychoanalysis, in a way, has to go slowly. It has to go associatively. It has to meander. That's why psychoanalyses are long. That's why there is this strange effect of being in analysis where you sort of, you have a session. And of course, some sessions can be genuinely revelatory and important, but some can be important in a way because they weren't important, because you sort of talk through a few things. It was a bit aimless. There might have been a bit of insight. There might have been a bit of silence. But somehow you've tuned in to an element, a way of being that tends to be excluded from kind of the workaday reality of most of our lives.
That kind of possibility of aimlessness, that possibility of not actually having to produce anything, is that enough for people in distress, for people in need of help?
It can be. It can be actually an immense relief, particularly if the distress does have something to do with a kind of overburdened mind. I mean, certainly in those examples of burnout that I talk about in the first part of the book, there is something about immediate liberation from the obligation to produce something. You know, unlike more behaviorally oriented therapies, we don't set homework. We don't think that people need to read psychoanalysis, although it's fine if they do. They don't need to sort of work around the therapy. In a way, they can just sit there or lie there, and they can just talk or not talk. And that sense of a kind of holiday from the obligations to be fulfilling a target or to be doing something in particular does have an immediate relieving effect. Is it enough? Almost certainly not. But it creates the conditions, if you're lucky, if the cards fall in the right way, you have the right analyst with the right patient, then it creates the conditions for it being enough.
And for the rest of us, with the new year opening before us, you may be feeling that there's an endless list of things to do. Do we need to find something similar in our own lives, a space for doing nothing?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I like the idea of psychoanalysis as a kind of good exemplar of doing nothing rather than the thing that you have to do to learn to do nothing, because that sounds rather didactic and also rather smug, because after all, not everybody has the time or the money to invest in 6 months or a year or 8 years of analysis. Analysis gives you a certain orientation to the world, I think, and that orientation really is a valuing of that dimension of our minds, which I think is very large, in which mental activity occurs without any purpose, without any sense of what it's doing. And we have a tendency to dismiss or even really make fun of that part of our minds. And really, one of the things that I'm trying to encourage in this book is a kind of a curiosity about that part of the mind that goes more in the direction of inactivity and doing less rather than doing more.
So maybe we should just, right here, right now, maybe we should just agree to down tools.
That would be very good.
So there's four categories. There's slob, burnout, slacker, or daydreamer. I could definitely be all four of those things simultaneously, probably, let alone in the same day. What about you, Richard?
I don't know. I reckon for me, the touchstone is slacker. The Big Lebowski is, you know, is the way to go.
I'm imagining you in the sort of the dude's robe, buying milk at the supermarket.
I don't know if I stretch to a robe exactly. there are people who around in my family who'd definitely finger me out as a slob. But
I've seen your desk. I know that's true. That was Richard speaking to Josh Cohen, and his book Not Working, Why We Have to Stop is published by Granta. And we'll be back right after this with the books we're most looking forward to in 2019.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome back. Over the last few months, we've begun to collect piles of books for 2019 on our desks. Claire has joined us. Hello, Claire.
Hi.
Are you pleased to be back at work?
Oh, I wouldn't exactly put it like that. Less time to read books, obviously.
We were just talking to Josh Cohen about his book Not Working, but there's a couple other books that are coming out that are about not working as well, right?
Yeah, I wondered whether this was the beginning of a trend. One always begins the year looking for what's going to be the big fashion for the coming season. And I thought I might have spotted an anti-work trend because there is also another January book called Lab Rats by Dan Lyons. It's subtitled Why Modern Work Makes People Miserable. But Richard thinks it might be just a bit of two canny publishers thinking of something to fill the January gap.
I slightly think it's a bit of a canny January move.
But I mean, we've had so much stuff about work, haven't we? I think we might have a bit of a leisure boom coming up. I mean, after all, it's what faces quite a lot of us, doesn't it?
Well, we've all got a bit of obsession with this idea of the four-day work week that, you know, we keep seeing businesses in New Zealand doing, and then we wistfully sort of look out the window and dream of a better future and go back to our desks and our computers. It's a sort of thing that it's sort of like sleep. It's sort of one of those things that's just going to be like perennially interesting to us, isn't it?
Yeah, and also at this time of year, it's a bit of a fantasy, isn't it? You're just knuckling down to
not work and sleeping properly. Absolute dream.
Actually, having started on a bit of a negative note, I actually have seen, my eyes have been lighting up like a candy shop looking at the catalogues. We have on the books desk, we collate all the books that are coming up in the year into this huge, great long list, which has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books in it. And it sort of is a book lover's sweetie shop, really, isn't it?
Yeah, some very exciting things.
Them. You don't get fat on them.
It's kind of great because you go through it and you just sort of go, ooh, that's nice. I'll make note of that sort of thing. And then when it actually comes out, it's very exciting because you sort of got a taster for it about 3 months before.
Yeah, occasionally they just pass by and you think, I was looking forward to that.
Oh,
whoops.
I was really excited about that 6 months ago and I haven't read it at all.
So, I mean, if we're talking about the sort of things that are news stories almost or may shape up into news stories, one of the things I'm looking forward to is Kristen Rupenian's You Know You Want This, which is short stories. She was the writer who did this New Yorker short story, Cat Person, got a huge amount of publicity for, and it was very clever. It was slightly in the Sally Rooney vein, wasn't it?
Yes.
Just think this is modern millennial angst,
yes,
writ large, and it's sort of the script to our new lives that we've all been looking for, and particularly people like you, Sian, have been looking for.
I don't know if I was looking for it because I ended up having to write about five bloody articles about the same short story in the end. But I do think that she's got a real talent for recording the realities of dating and the reality realities of work and just sort of like young people's lives right now. She's really nailed it, and she is a bit like Sally in that way, that she has nailed it. So I'm excited for that collection too.
When's that due?
That's out in March. And then on the in slightly the same vein, I went over to Dublin to interview Sally just before Christmas, and I was asking her about who her contemporaries are, because there is a sense of this huge energy coming out of Ireland at the moment. And we all know about people like Kevin Barry and people who've been around for a bit, but there's a new generation, a lot of whom are coming through this magazine called Stinging Fly, which Sally Rooney has edited the last two editions of. And one of the writers that she mentioned is Nicole Flattery, whose collection of short stories, Show Them a Good Time, is out also in March. So we're always interested as journalists as to whether this might be the next new big thing. Probably won't, but there you go.
I read one of Nicole Flattery's short stories in Stinging Fly. It was a terrific story. It's great.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to that as well, actually.
Yeah.
Richard, what books are you looking forward to this year?
Yeah, well, one something that's happening almost right now, I mean, it's published just later in the month, is Lewis Dartnell, who's got a book called Origins, a Bodily Header bringing out at the end of this month, which charts how humans are shaped by the planet that we come from. It's kind of a geology and evolution and all that, and how that feeds into kind of things like this. It's an extraordinary map he's got in there of the presidential election from 2016 with there's this line of blue of people voting Democrat across the South in Alabama and Georgia and so on. And he traces that back to the presence of rocks, which were laid down 75 million years ago. It's the most extraordinary story. Mm. And it's a big picture history at its best.
Do you think that big picture history is as current now as it was? I mean, I was wondering whether it had slightly gone out of fashion.
Well, his take on it is that he's doing something slightly new because he's a scientist. His research is in it, whether there's life has been existing on Mars before. And he tries to bring this kind of scientific take to it to try and underpin these stories with research from peer-reviewed research from papers. So he's trying to do something slightly different, I think. But it's also a nice way of getting slightly further away from the hurly-burly of everyday life and, you know, the next crisis at Westminster or Donald Trump or whatever, and taking a slightly larger view, which I think is an appeal that won't go away.
And how about fiction for you?
In fiction, I'm very much looking forward to something from Valeria Luiselli. Her stuff is fantastic. I mean, the last thing we had her on was a collection of essays about children coming from South America into the US and the legal trouble they get. And this is a kind of novel which explores the same sort of territory. And that's part of the reason why I think it's so interesting, because it's such a vital issue. This, the migrants, I think, is going to be this year, next year, the year to come. It's going to define our time. And it's a novel which looks at a family going around the South of the United States, as she did herself with her husband and her kids in 2014. She talked about it last time. So it reimagines that journey and also puts it alongside the journeys of people coming the other way.
And being a Mexican who lives in the States, she's sort of perfectly placed to be the chronicler of this, isn't she?
Yeah, very much so. I'm looking forward to seeing if there's novels from people in Europe that do much the same thing with the kind of Mediterranean transfer as well.
So one I'm quite excited about, and one that I've actually already started, is the new Marlon James book. Everyone will remember that Marlon James won the 2016 Man Booker Prize for his book, A Brief History of Seven Killings. And he's got his next book out, which is called Black Leopard, Red Wolf, which is the first in a big sort of African fantasy trilogy that he's been working on for quite a long time. So this is going to be the first installment in that. And it follows a guy called Tracker, who is a hunter, who is tasked with finding a child. He's given the task of hunting down this child, and he teams up with a sort of band of mercenaries. And when he starts this sort of quest, he starts questioning the reasons why he's been assigned to find this child. And I've only just started it, but it looks really, really exciting.
Is it definitely fantasy, not SF?
Yes. I mean, it's a sort of thing that it's fantasy, but he sort of talked about like trying to make a sort of like African Middle Earth sort of thing. So he's
because
got
there's
that
been a
whole
bit of science fiction coming from with kind of African roots, and but I haven't seen fantasy very much.
No, I mean, it's the sort of thing like there's a writer called Nnedi Okorafor who's done a real blend of the two, and there is this whole sort of boom. I think things like Black Panther and interest in Afrofuturism. This really doesn't feel like Afrofuturism. It feels like fantasy, but very rooted in African mythology. So it might veer into sort of a bit of Afrofuturism, because it's certainly not necessarily a world that we would recognise. So he could go there in perhaps books two and three, but it's feeling very unique, and I'm really enjoying it.
Such
weighty book.
So unexpected. I never would have expected Marlon James to go down that route.
Well, there was an interview he did with The Observer a couple years ago. I think it was just sort of like around when Seven Killings came out in paperback or something, and someone asked him what he was going to be working on next, and he sort of sold it as like a big Viking-esque African fantasy. And as soon as he said sort of African Vikings, I was like, hell yeah.
But I mean, that's exactly what Tolkien did with the myths of the North, didn't it? I mean, and there's no reason why myths from Africa couldn't have exactly the same kind of richness.
Exactly. Yeah. And so as soon as someone says, oh, well, I'm doing that, you're like, hell yeah, you're doing that. No one else is. I want to read it.
There's another book that's kind of rooted in Africa that I'm looking forward to as well. It's from Elizabeth Jane Burnett, who has published her first book of poetry, I think last year, with Penned in the Margins. We talked to her. And this is the memoir that she was talking about working on when she was when she was talking about her book of poetry. So she's one of the first writers to come through the Penguin Random House Right Now program, which they launched in 2016 to look for, as they say, underrepresented voices we don't usually see on the bookshelves. And it's a very interesting story that she's got, because her dad's from Devon, from this Devon village where she grew up, and her mother's from Kenya. And so she's kind of digging back into soil and family life, and actually the death of her father, who died just recently. So I'm really looking forward to that. It's coming in March from Alan Lane.
While we're on that particular, the theme of underrepresented voices, one of the ones I am very excited about is J. Bernard's Surge. Mm. J. Bernard won the Ted Hughes Award with a work in progress last year. And this is their first published collection. And J. is transgender and Black and a fabulously good historian. And this Surge apparently goes from the New Cross fire back in the 1980s, which they've already written about, to Grenfell Tower. So I think it's going to be political, meaty, and you know their talent is actually without question.
Is there a sort of show, a live event that goes with it, or is it just
this is what's really interesting. Again, it's, you know, you talk about underrepresented communities. The performance poetry community is incredibly underrepresented on the page,
on the shelf.
They are on the shelf, not in the arena. Mm. So this sort of crossover thing, I think, is really exciting.
Now, there's another right now mentee who's got a book out. Nels Abbey has got a satirical kind of self-help book called Think Like a White Man, which Canongate bring out in May, which I haven't seen at all yet. But it says you should follow the white man commandment, which is to winning justifies anything and everything.
So although it's a Penguin Random House initiative, it's not them who are necessarily publishing the resulting books.
No, I think it's a kind of mentoring program that helps people develop their work, mm-hmm. and then after that they may or may not get a book deal with Penguin Random House.
Yeah, because just before Christmas, actually, I went up to Durham to interview Pat Barker, and we were talking about working class voices and minority voices, and she was saying, oh, she had a feeling that actually publishing was really, really beginning to make strides, and including getting regional voices.
That's like about time, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I was when I left, I was wondering whether she was being a bit sort of Panglossian about it, whether that was actually true. But it is true that a lot of this, that there has been a lot of groundwork laid. It's like the piping's been laid underneath the pavements, and sooner or later there'll suddenly be a subway exit, and that they'll all come.
Right. Well, I've got a couple of like big names to sort of contrast against all the new names that we've just spoken about. First of all, biggest news of the year, probably in terms of book announcements, was Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale sequel, The Testaments, which is due in September. We don't really know very much at this stage, but we just know that it's going to be diverging from where the television programme of The Handmaid's Tale has gone, and it will be telling the story through the perspectives of three different women. So not necessarily just Offred, who was the protagonist in The Handmaid's Tale. Also in April, we've got the new Ian McEwan, which is The Machines Like Me, which does sound really quite interesting to me. I remember when this was announced, Claire, we were talking about McEwan and his sort of whether he's ever really entered into sci-fi territory. And then we looked into it and realised that actually he's got a really long history of going into sort of science fiction areas.
In fact, Atonement started out as a science fiction novel.
Yeah, exactly.
Fact. That's a pub quiz fact.
And so this one's really very firmly in that territory. And it's set in an alternate London in the 1980s. And it's Thatcher versus Tony Benn. And Alan Turing is still alive and has made some great advancements in AI technology. And it sort of focuses on a love triangle between two human individuals and then an AI individual. And it sounds quite cool. There was a slightly ropey short story that sort of touched on AI that went in the Daily Mail recently, and I read it and went, oh God, Ian, please tell me this isn't part of your book, because this is actually quite bad. But I've got my fingers crossed for the book that it might be a bit better.
And talking about people, well-known writers making departures into fantasy or myth or whatever one calls it. And there's also coming out in May, Mark Haddon is back.
Oh,
Mark
yeah.
Haddon.
So what's he doing?
The Curious Incident, The Dog in the Nighttime, who his most recent novel, The Red House, was published 7 years ago.
Wow.
And it was totally undervalued. I was having a conversation about it with a publishing friend the other day. And we were both saying, well, why did people not get that book? You know, it's just one of those things. It just slightly missed. I think it was too subtle. He wears his sophistication so lightly. He's one of those writers that's sort of in danger of going under the radar. He has since written a really good collection of short stories called The Pier Falls. But I think he's just getting better and better. And so here we have him back again with The Porpoise, which is based on the story of Pericles, Prince of Tyre, who we obviously know of Pericles from Shakespeare, but he goes back into sort of the 14th century to medieval poem. And it's sort of modern lives mixed with myth, sea, land, dramatic chases, dangers, peril, you know, plane heading from disaster.
But doesn't sound like Mark Haddon at
it's,
all.
I know. But I have two people I really trust have read it, and they say it's absolutely brilliant.
Oh, great.
So
how exciting.
Go, Mark.
Well done, Mark. Just a couple last books that I am very excited about. There is an unnamed Thomas Harris thriller to come, which is his first non-Hannibal book for 40 years, which I'm actually quite excited about, though I'm very sad to not have the sassy cannibal back in another book, but I will probably read this regardless. But
I have to look at your psychology, Sean, when you describe Hannibal as sassy.
He's so sassy. He's such a snob. I kind of love him. That's due out in May. So I'm looking forward to that. But we don't have any plot, and we don't have any title, and we don't have a cannibal. So.
And a couple of extra ones from me. One is Gingerbread by Helen Oyeyemi, which is out in March. It's a magic realist London set fairy tale story. People will remember her from novels including Mr. Fox, amazingly inventive writer who pops up not as frequently as we would like, but is always worth watching. And the other one is Lanny, which is a novel from Max Porter, who arrived from nowhere with Grief is the Thing with Feathers. Mm. He's amazing. He's a former bookseller who became a publisher and now has taken to writing like a bird to the air. And this is described as Under Milk Woodish. It's about a village outside London, and it's one of those multi-voice narratives.
Yeah, and he's got playing all sorts of games with the text, which kind of flies all over the page. It looks really amazing.
So you've actually seen it?
Yeah, yeah. No, kind of. There's crosses and dots flying around as well. And as you say, it's kind of chapter by chapter. It's different people speaking, and this kind of old grandpa figure who kind of strides across it, as far as I can see. It's very interesting. And we haven't had much non-fiction, so I might mention David Kynaston and Frances Green. You've got a book in February called Engines of Privilege about the inequality driven by public schools and also what might be done about it, which I think is very urgent. And Emma Dabiri, who's due in March from Annan Lane, with a personal history of black hair and kind of the meaning of that and how that's changed over the years. And then continuing with non-fiction, we've got Sarah Pascoe a little later in the year, in August, with Sex, Power, Money, which is the book she was promising when she was on the podcast talking about animals. She was promising to write a book about men and porn, which made me cringe. But she's delivering it in August, so we have that to look forward to as well.
Lovely. Well, so we've got a bunch of anti-work books. We've got some underrepresented voices, new approaches to fantasy, and a new boom in Ireland. There's so much to look forward to this year, and hopefully we'll have some of these authors on the show later in the year too. Thank you for joining us for another year of reading, and remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. From me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Richard Lee.
Thank you and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.